Fatherless Fanny by Anonymous. Chapter 28, Part 2. At length the sweet creature was restored to my prayers, and I received the heart-soothing tidings of her safety and amended health. This joyful event was followed by another, which appeared to promise us the confirmation of our happiness. I mean the death of Lord Summertown, which happened suddenly just before Lord Balafin's expected arrival. I will not repeat the gay visions of happiness that floated in our brain. I will not repeat the gay visions of happiness that floated on my brain when I heard of an event so propitious to our hopes of liberty, as I never entertained a fear that Lord Sheldon could resemble his father so closely as I have since found, to my sorrow, that he did. The death of Lord Summertown put a stop to all ideas of the proposed alliance with Lord B. for some time, and as the new lord was still detained abroad by his diplomatic functions, Emily was left for several months to follow the bent of her own inclination. It may easily be supposed that it was the society of her husband that she would seek under such circumstances, and many a half-gone hour have we spent together in these very apartments, whose private communications with Pemberton Abbey had been but lately discovered by a servant of mine, who informed me of it, and showed me the secret spring that closed the mysterious panel. As a reward for so valuable a discovery, I settled £50 a year upon the man, and gave him that small house to live in. And with the assistance of his wife, and the worthy Mrs. Bolton, whom you have hitherto known by the name of your Mama Sidney, your beloved mother in this secluded asylum gave birth to a lovely infant, who was immediately baptized by the name of Fanny. And such were the precautions adverted to on this occasion, that not the slightest suspicions were awakened amongst the domestics at Sheldon Park, who were all, excepting one confidential servant, wholly ignorant of my Emily's absence. As soon as her weakness would permit, she returned to her home, but you was left here with your nurse, the wife of my servant. We now awaited Lord Sheldon's return with the utmost impatience, as we had come to the resolution of declaring our marriage to him at the first interview. Alas, had we known the horrors that would be the consequence of his return, we should have fled to some distant climate whilst the possibility of flight remained within our power. Such, however, was our infatuation, that we dreamt not of our danger until the dark cloud of irremediable misfortune burst over our devoted heads and crushed us forever. But I will not dwell upon this dreadful part of our narrative. As soon as Lord Summertown arrived in London, he wrote to his niece to inform her that the nuptials, which he was sorry had been so long delayed on his account, should be solemnized immediately, and that it was his intention to be at Sheldon Park in 10 days from the date of his letter. When Emily communicated this unwelcome news to me, my mind suggested the propriety of immediately informing Lord Summertown of our marriage, and entreating his sanction to it, as I judged it would only exasperate him the more to suffer him to come down in the country under such erroneous ideas. I accordingly wrote to him on the subject, with an eloquence that would have moved any heart but his own. His answer was couched in terms the most friendly, and contained only a very slight stricture upon secret marriages, which he said were but too often the cause of much unhappiness in families, adding that he hoped ours would not prove of that description. His lordship requested my immediate presence in London, as he said it was necessary we should have some conversation together previous to his visiting the country, and he concluded his letter with every assurance of the most cordial friendship. This was so much above my hopes that I was in ecstasies, and my Emily was several times obliged to check my transports. Indeed, her apparent apathy soon moderated my joy, for I saw she did not seem to exhilarate as I did. And if anything could have made me angry with that angel, I should have been so on that occasion, for I was disappointed with her coldness. Alas, hers was a presentiment of evil which the subsequent events too soon justified. To be brief, I tore myself away from the dearest part of my soul, and commenced my ill-fated journey full of the most pleasing expectations, little imagining that I had seen my Emily for the last time. When I arrived in London, I waited upon Lord Summertown immediately, and was received with the utmost cordiality. As soon as the first compliments were over, I began speaking upon the subject of the settlements, and, as my uncle had authorized me to do, I made the most liberal offers. Lord Summertown seemed rather to evade than to press the subject, and he once said, with a rather mysterious air, "There are some circumstances with which I am acquainted that perhaps you do not suspect are known to me. On some future day we will talk over those matters, as I should wish the real rank of the man my niece marries should be known to the world." I caught at this insinuation, and assured his lordship that from that moment I could have no secrets with a friend so nearly allied to me. "Not now," said he, nodding significantly, "but the time is not far distant when the confidence will be mutual." There was something in Lord Summertown's manner of pronouncing these words that did not please me. As I could not make any objection to what he said, I was obliged to be silent. I wrote an account of this interview to my adored Emily, and also to my uncle. A few days after this, I received a note from Lord Summertown requesting me to dine with him at his villa on the banks of the Thames, near Richmond, as he had some business to transact with me of the utmost importance. I obeyed the fatal summons with alacrity, and reached the appointed place just as dinner was ready. Lord Summertown welcomed me by a cordial shake of the hand, assuring me that I had made him happy by this ready compliance with his request. "And I trust," added he with a smile, "that you will confess before we part that I am not your debtor. Everything is arranged for your future welfare in a manner that cannot fail of success." I understood by this speech that Lord Summertown alluded to my claims on the title and estates of Albemarle, and I expressed my warm sense of his kind attention to my interest. "Say not a word about it," answered he. "You cannot judge how much you are obliged to me until you know what I have done for you. The dinner waits. Let us defer business till that is over." I followed the fiend into the dining parlour. We dined tête-à-tête, but as the servants waited, not a word passed during dinner. After the cloth was removed, I adverted to the subject of our former correspondence. But Lord Summertown pressed me to take some wine with such eagerness that I could not refuse. Glass after glass was pressed upon me, which I swallowed much against my inclination, merely to get rid of his importunity. I did not at first perceive that Lord Summertown was not drinking himself, for my mind was so occupied with the ideas that crowded upon it that I had scarcely any perception of what was passing before me. When, however, I did observe it, I declined drinking any more. "Your lordship," said I, laughing, has a design upon me, for you are making me drink whilst you are abstaining from wine yourself."
"There may be reasons," answered he, "that may render it more necessary for you to take wine than would stand good for me. However, I believe you have taken enough," added he emphatically, "and therefore you may do as you like about having any more." There was something very mysterious in Lord Summertown's manner, but as I had no suspicion of his malice to me, it excited my curiosity without alarming me. After conversing for some time longer upon indifferent subjects, and studiously avoiding the one I wished to lead to, Lord Summertown, after looking earnestly at his watch for some minutes, suddenly started up.
"It is time," said he, "to drop the mask of dissimulation. The drug I have administered must have taken effect, and I should lose half my vengeance if my victim remained in ignorance of the hand that inflicted the blow." As Lord Summertown spoke, I involuntarily rose from my chair, and a vague presentiment of the truth came over my mind, at least of Lord Summertown's malice to me, for I thought he had administered poison in my wine. I was mistaken. Death was too merciful a doom to be awarded by the monster to the man he hated. The drug was intended to render me inanimate, and by suspending my powers, to make me the easy victim of his deep-laid scheme. Too certain in its effects, I already felt the all-subduing influence creeping over my frame, and whilst horror and resentment struggled at my breast, my unnerved limbs trembled beneath my weight, and almost refused to sustain me, whilst I listened to the sentence pronounced by my arch-enemy. "No," said he, in a voice trembling with rage and guilt, "no, unhappy wretch, that I am acquainted with your origin. Yes, I am informed that you are the offspring of that proud beauty who scorned my proffered love, and of my detested rival, whose insidious arts made her forget her duty, and rendered her blind to the superior merit that sued for her affection. My father hated your parents, and I inherit his hatred with his title. Your mother eluded my vengeance by death. Your father also escaped me. But their offspring is mine, and I shall have glorious revenge. I see your senses are becoming torpid through the influence of that drug you have swallowed. I will therefore hasten to inform you that you are doomed to live, but to exist in such a state of wretchedness that death would be a mercy. Remember, your misery flows from me. Oh, forget not that circumstance, or I have but half my vengeance. Your wife, too, my degenerate niece, who has dared to unite her fate to that of an enemy of her family, shall have an equal portion of suffering. Let that reflection gall you, and add to the anguish of perpetual slavery. The manner of her punishment I shall not tell you, for suspense and doubt aggravate affliction of every kind. Know this only: she shall wed another." The drug had begun its operation indeed, and a torpor not to be resisted was creeping over my whole frame. Yet when Lord Summertown pronounced the last fatal words, "She shall wed another," my expiring senses were awakened, and the fury that transported my soul inspired one last effort of strength. I flew and seized the collar of my insulting foe. But whilst I held him struggling in my grasp, he contrived to stamp with his foot, and several of his creatures came to his assistance. I was easily secured, for the short-lived energy had already subsided, and my stiffening limbs and stupefied senses overpowered me more than the united strength of the bravos.
From this moment I remembered nothing more until I found myself confined in a narrow, inconvenient recess, which appeared intended for a bed. But the cruel way in which my hands and feet were manacled prevented me from stretching myself upon it so as to obtain any rest. Impenetrable darkness enveloped me, but the constant splashing of water close to my head convinced me that I was upon the sea in some vessel, destined by my persecutor to convey me far from that happy land where unjust imprisonment is forbidden by the laws. At first I was at a loss to account for my wretched situation, but by degrees my recollection returned, and the dreadful truth flashed on my awakening senses. It is surprising to me at this moment that frenzy did not seal my wretchedness, for I remembered the dreadful words, "She shall wed another," and in the agony they excited, I attempted to tear off the manacles that confined me. The effort I made was attended with so much noise that it brought one of the ship's crew to my little cabin.
"What's in the wind now?" exclaimed he in a rough tone. "You had better be quiet, my hearty. You will be worse off if you don't mind what you are about. And considering the crimes you have been guilty of, it is no great matter."
"Crimes?" reiterated I. "What crimes can possibly be made to my charge, who never injured any one?"
"You did not do what you wished to do," replied the tar, "but that was no thanks to you."
"Tell me, I entreat you," said I, "of what am I accused?"
"Oh, you have forgot it, have you?" answered he. "That's comical, too, by jingo. Well, then I'll rub up your memory a bit. Don't you remember when you attempted to kill your uncle, Lord Summertown?"
"I attempted to kill Lord Summertown?" interrupted I. "Heavens, what a falsehood! I never even dreamt of such a thing."
"Why, as for that, you know best," replied the tar. "But it argifies very little now to deny it. I should think it very unlikely such a thing should be invented of an innocent man. But the short and the long of it is that your uncle says you did so, and out of compassion to you, and to save the disgrace of having you hanged, he had you conveyed on board our vessel whilst you were dead drunk. For when you found your wicked intention was frustrated, you took a quantity of laudanum in hopes to escape your deserts. But it was not enough to kill you, and as the affair was blowed, you must have been prosecuted if your good uncle had not sent you beyond seas. We shall land you as soon as we find a convenient place, for we don't want the company of murderers in the Blithe Betsy, I can assure you. But we will take care it shall be where you are not likely to get away from it again."
The agony of my mind at this intelligence may easily be imagined. At first I gave way to despair, and vented my anguish in exclamations of sorrow. But recollecting how fruitless was such weakness, I determined to subdue it. Whilst life was spared me, escape was not impossible. And when I thought upon the cruel situation of my beloved Emily, it awakened such an ardent desire to rescue her that it gave a supernatural strength to my mind and supported me through the severest of trials. As soon as my informer could be prevailed upon to listen to me, I told my plain, unvarnished tale, and laid open to the honest seaman a train of iniquity that shocked his simple nature. He, who had been taught to hate me as a murderer, now pitied me as an oppressed victim of the blackest treachery. He determined upon my deliverance with all the ardor of increased benevolence, and unloosing the manacles that confined me as a pledge of his future services, he bade me be of good cheer, for he was certain his captain, who, though rough as the element he ploughed, was generous and humane, would scorn to be the implement of oppression in the hands of a tyrant like Lord Summertown. He had been prevailed upon to take charge of me for a large reward, under the supposition that he was doing an act of mercy to a culprit who merited death, by giving him a chance of living to repent of his crimes. At the same time, he was saving a noble family from the stigma of being allied to a felon. As soon, therefore, as my new friend Jack Thompson had repeated my melancholy story to him, and removed the prejudice that had hitherto kept him from speaking to me, I was ordered into his cabin, and received from Captain Armstrong the credit my narrative deserved. From that moment I was free, and treated with the same kindness as the chief mate, who was also his nephew. The generous Armstrong was, however, bound to the coast of Africa, and as I was eager beyond expression to return to England, that I might ascertain the fate of her who was dearer to me than life, he kindly promised to put me on board the first vessel we should meet with, bound to my native shore.
"And when ye get there, my friend," said he, "keep close under hatches, or hoist false colours to deceive the enemy, until Roger Armstrong returns to his moorings. Then never fear, but we will work him pretty tightly. Your testimony will argify nothing without a witness. You had better, therefore, be mum till you can jaw him to some purpose."
End of chapter 28.